I think I said that we might start with a question if you have one. Maybe we got all our questions dealt with during the break. Or you've given up completely. Anyway, we're talking about the ninth chapter of the book of Daniel, the so-called Daniel timetable. And I was talking a little bit about chronologies and the problems that we have there. I mentioned to you, and by the way, I should maybe preface with a couple of things. In the first place, don't be worried that I'm going to put your children through all this. When I have my sessions with them, we'll probably do other things. I just thought I should maybe make that clear. And also, I understood that on the break there were women in the bathroom rejoicing that maybe they're 11 days younger than they thought they were. Happy to be of service. Another thing that came up during the break that I may or may not have pointed out, but it certainly should be pointed out, and that is that Xerxes is the same as the Ahasuerus of the book of Esther, and Xerxes is the father of Artaxerxes I, called Longimanus. Xerxes is the father, Artaxerxes Longimanus is the son, and they are right together as kings. Xerxes is the first king, and Artaxerxes is king right after him. And I'm going to be telling you that I think they may have been king together in a co-regency for the last part of Xerxes' reign. But I'll tell you how we get to that possibility. I mentioned the canon of Ptolemy, and that he selects the year 464 for the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus, and that Usher sets his date aside in favor of the year 473, based on older historical data than Ptolemy used. Also, this question came up during the break, so I'll mention it again. To my knowledge, all chronologists agree that Xerxes came to the Persian throne about 486 BC, and that his son, Artaxerxes Longimanus, died around 424 BC. There's very little, if any, question. I just don't see any question in this on any charts that I've seen. Xerxes begins in 486. Artaxerxes Longimanus ends in 424 or 423. The only thing in dispute here is the very piece of information that we need to understand the Daniel timetable, and that is the year when Artaxerxes, the son of Xerxes, ascended the throne. Usher's objection to the traditional received chronology depended partly on the testimony of Thucydides. And if we had a blackboard, I'd write Thucydides there, but he's T-H-U-C-Y-D-I-D-E-S. Thucydides is a very important Greek historian. There are some Greek historians, in fact, most Greek historians really aren't very important so far as helping us with our understanding of things. But Thucydides is called the prince of Greek historians, just as Tacitus is the prince of the Roman historians. You may have heard that. Tacitus is important and helps us with some of our understanding about New Testament-type things he wrote around that time. So Tacitus is the prince of the Roman historians, but Thucydides is known as the prince of the Greek historians. Thucydides wrote in a very polished Greek. In fact, if somebody's trying to learn the Greek language, very often one of the earlier things that they read when they really get going with it is the Peloponnesian War written by Thucydides. Spell Thucydides. T-H-U-C-Y-D-I-D-E-S. Yes, T-H-U-C-Y-D-I-D-E-S. Now, by the way, when I pronounce these names, I'm often pronouncing names that I've never heard pronounced, but I've only read. Thucydides I actually have heard pronounced, so I'm pretty sure that's the right pronunciation or the accepted pronunciation. But other names I'm going to be saying are just my guess about how they would be pronounced because I've never heard some of them pronounced. I'll try to keep the names to a minimum, but there are a few that I should mention to you. I hate to bring Thucydides into it, but I feel like I have to, so you'll know why I'm not fudging the dates. Thucydides states that Artaxerxes Longimanus had just come to the throne when Themistocles, which is another Greek name, Themistocles had fled a false charge over in Athens and was running to the Persian courts. Remember, in these days it was the Greeks against the Persians. They were fighting it out to see who was going to win. And so this man was falsely accused at Athens, and he flees to the Persian king at the Persian court, and he gets over there as rapidly as he can. And Thucydides said, and we're using the information that we get from the historians to try to date things, Thucydides said that Longimanus had just come to the throne when Themistocles, and that's T-H-E-M-I-S-T-O-C-L-E-S, T-H-E-M-I-S-T-O-C-L-E-S. Not that the spelling is important at all, but just you can put T-H-E-M for short if you want. Themistocles. Thucydides says that Longimanus had just come to the throne in Persia when Themistocles, having fled a false charge in Greece at Athens, arrived at the Persian court to get away from the Grecians who were going to do away with him. And Thucydides places the flight of Themistocles between two notable events. Now, this is where it gets really sticky. I know you don't want to do this any more than I do, but I don't know any way around it. We've already come this far. Let's push just a little bit further. Please try to hang with me. You're doing great. I appreciate the encouragement during the break because I was ready to go a different direction if you said to, but there was enough encouragement. We'll go just a little bit further with this. Thucydides places the flight of Themistocles between two notable events, one of which occurred in 474, 473 BC, and the other of which occurred in 470 BC. I can furnish you information on those two events if you want them from the work of Thucydides. I don't think most of you want them. Well, I'll tell you. The first of these was the siege of Naxos, N-A-X-O-S, and the second was the famous victory over the Persians by the Athenian general Cimon, C-I-M-O-N, at the mouth of the river Eurythmidon. See, that's why I gave you the dates and wasn't going to tell you what it was that happened in those. But Thucydides places the flight of Themistocles right or between these two notable events. Not right between them, but somewhere between these. Now, let's talk about Plutarch for a moment. Plutarch is very famous, and I suspect that all of you have heard of him. He wrote a series, I have it in three volumes. You may have it in three or more, depending on how they divided it up. But it's called The Lives of Illustrious Men. And in his work on Themistocles, he connects the death of Themistocles with the expedition of Cimon. So we have testimony from Thucydides, and we have testimony from Plutarch that Themistocles was connected somewhere close to the expedition of Cimon. Plutarch added that, like Thucydides, Charon of Lampsacus, who was a contemporary of Thucydides, Plutarch says that like Thucydides, there was a man named Charon of Lampsacus who was a contemporary of Themistocles, and he said that Xerxes was dead and that his son Artaxerxes was the king who received Themistocles when he got to the Persian court. And Plutarch went on to name four others who maintained that Xerxes was actually alive at the time that Themistocles came to the Persian court. This is what I mean by source issues. We look at the sources and they say different things. We've got people saying that Xerxes was dead when Themistocles got to the Persian court. We've got other people saying that Xerxes was alive when Themistocles came to the Persian court. And they say that it was actually he with whom the interview was conducted rather than the interview conducted by Artaxerxes when Themistocles got there. But Plutarch says that the chronological data seemed to him to favor Thucydides over the opinions of these later writers. And the reason would be that Thucydides is writing back at that time. These later writers are writing later on when the stream of history has become polluted by alternate so-called facts. So it's good to read historians who are close to the time of the things that you're reading about. Another historian by the name of Diodorus Siculus, although he believes Xerxes to still be king, he dates the arrival at Themistocles at the Persian court as 471 B.C. Cicero gives the year of the flight of Themistocles as 472. Eusebius says 473. So you can see that we have varying ancient testimonies. That's the point. Last hour we talked about calendric issues. Now we're talking about source issues. We have ancient testimonies that vary from one another. And the resolution of all this, unquestionably, in my mind at least, favors the authority of Thucydides and Charon of Lampsacus, because unlike all the other voices, they were writing as contemporaries to the facts, and I think that's very important. Thucydides is the so-called prince of the Greek historians. He was contemporary with Artaxerxes Longimanus, and he was born around the time of the flight of Themistocles. So he could have heard about it from his parents' generation and gotten the information from people who were eyewitnesses. Charon's testimony must be highly regarded because he was a writer of history living in Lampsacus in Asia near the Hellespont, or what we sometimes call the Dardanelles, at the very time of the arrival of Themistocles there. This is the same Lampsacus that was later on given to Themistocles. Charon, I'm pronouncing it Charon, it's C-H-A-R-O-N. Thank you, Tom. C-H-A-R-O-N. The only reason I'm pronouncing it that way is because of the boatman who took people across the River Styx. I think his name was spelled like that, and they call him Charon, so I'm calling this guy Charon. Hope. It doesn't matter to me how we pronounce it as long as we know who we're talking about. My point here is that the oldest witnesses for the opposition position which I hold, the opposition position which I do not hold and which I am questioning, they lived more than a century after the event. The man called Euphorus, who holds to the traditional position, outlived the death of Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great died in 323 BC, so that's way on past. Clitarchus accompanied Alexander, and Dinon was his father. So we're talking about people way, way far into the 4th century, almost to the end of the 4th century before Christ. The first man, as far as I know, to raise a doubt about the usually accepted date of the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus was James Usher. He's the one that made the chronology of the history of the world. He raised a doubt on this issue in 1613. Eventually, in his Annals of the World, as he called it, he placed the date of Artaxerxes' first year as 473 B.C. This date was later adopted by Vitringa, a commentator, and nearly a century later, Kruger, who was working independently, got the same result. I always like it when two people get the same result while working independently. Sometimes you don't know if they work independently or not, but at least Kruger said that he was working independently when he got that. But it's like the controversy between Isaac Newton and Leibniz, you know, they both came up with calculus around the same time, supposedly independently of each other, but they're kind of in competition, and one guy's saying, well, he stole it from me, and so forth. So it's hard to know if they come up with it independently, but as far as I know, Kruger came up with it independently and got the same result. For over a century now, Hinstenberg has been known as a champion of the position that I am holding. And in his Christology of the Old Testament, he sets it forth very thoroughly. If you're interested in looking into this position, you can find it in page after page after page in Hinstenberg in Christology of the Old Testament. Now back to Ptolemy for a moment. We started out talking about Ptolemy's canon and the reason for the commonly accepted date of the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus being 464 BC is because that's what Ptolemy's canon said. This is the same Ptolemy who made astronomical observations and placed the earth at rest in the center of the universe with the planets and the other heavenly bodies circling the earth in fixed orbits. In the 9th century, Ptolemy's works were translated by the Arabians into their language, and then from them, their contents was made known to Europe around the time of the Renaissance, as I think you're aware. A lot of the enlightenment of the Renaissance came from books that had been translated out of the ancient languages into Arabic years before. And then they were translated out of the Arabic back into the vernacular languages of Europe sometimes, so that Europe could have a Renaissance too, after the heyday of the Muslims had sort of passed by. So anyway, this got back to Europe. Ptolemy's system represents the phenomena of the heavens as they actually appear to a spectator on earth. It's what we see when we look out at the world. And as I said in the first hour, I think this view maintained its hold on the European thought for 14 centuries. It wasn't superseded until the time of Copernicus, and it was Copernicus in 1543. who got us back to the heliocentric system, which had been taught in its essentials by Pythagoras back 500 years before Christ, 6 years before Ptolemy. 500 years before Christ, Pythagoras already believed in a heliocentric system, and it was Ptolemy who got us away from that and took us back into the Dark Ages, as it were, and we were there for a long time until we came back, led by Copernicus, into the system that had been used by Pythagoras 500 years before Christ. It was the Copernican system, as I think you know, who got Galileo into trouble with the Pope, because Galileo believed what Copernicus said, and he amplified that and worked on it, and the Pope said, well, that can't be right, and he excommunicated Galileo. And it's just been recently, I think it was John Paul II as Pope, who finally apologized to Galileo, but it was a little late for Galileo to enjoy it. Yes? Actually, Ezekiel was about 100 years before Pythagoras. Good question. Thank you. I should pause once in a while for questions. I hope you know to raise your hands if you have them or need to ask them. Now, back to Ptolemy's canon, and we're just about to get over the hump on this, if you can hang with me a while longer. Back to Ptolemy's canon. Ptolemy's the one that took us back into the Dark Ages, as it were, with his idea that's wrong about the nature of the universe and the solar system and how that all functions. He's got this canon, and all Ptolemy's canon is just a list of kings. That's all it is. When you hear about Ptolemy's canon, or when you see Ptolemy's canon, you may see an explanation of it. But that explanation of it is not a part of Ptolemy's canon. Ptolemy's canon is just a list of kings with the numbers of their reign, the number of years of their reigns. There'll be the king's name and then the number of years that he reigned, then the next king and the number of years that he reigned. Ptolemy's canon is not accompanied by any kind of an explanatory text. Ptolemy made no indication of and made no allowance for any co-regencies. And I think this is a key point. Now, Ptolemy's canon, maybe we should show the beginning and end of Ptolemy's canon. Ptolemy's canon ends with Antoninus Pius, the Roman emperor Antoninus Pius in the second century of the Christian era. But it starts clear back in 747 B.C. In 747 B.C., in the first year of King Nabopolassar of the Babylonians, King Nabonassar of the Babylonians, 747 B.C. So it starts in 747 B.C. It comes ahead for about 9 or 10 centuries, ending with Antoninus Pius in the second century of the Christian era. Ptolemy was writing about 100 years after Christ, and Ptolemy was neither an eyewitness nor a contemporary historian of the time of Artaxerxes Longimanus. Much of the challenge against Ptolemy's canon is based on statements by Sir Isaac Newton. I don't know if you realize what a profound student of parts of the Bible Sir Isaac Newton was, but he really was. He's known, we learn about him in school because of his physical laws. He's known as a great physicist, and indeed he was. But Isaac Newton was an absolute genius. He was a freak of nature. He was just as weird as if he'd been born with 6 fingers on each hand, as one of his biographers said. And he was a remarkable man. He was able to take information into his mind and calculate it. And he actually wrote more, and we didn't know this until after he had died, because he hid it. But he hid most of it. But he actually wrote more about the Bible, interpreting and understanding and defending the Bible, than he did about science. He was interested in science. He was interested in alchemy. He was very deeply involved in all of that. But he was more interested in the Bible, and he believed in it completely as the Word of God. He never questioned that at any point during his long life. And a lot of what he did biblically was to defend the Bible. He was also an Arian, and this is one reason he hid what he was doing biblically, because to be an Arian in England during his time was regarded as a great sin. And so he hid his Arianism. It's interesting that the man who was the chair of mathematics at Cambridge right after Isaac Newton, because Isaac Newton quit being the chair of mathematics at Cambridge to go and be the master of the mint in Great Britain. So the next man who was chair of mathematics in Cambridge was William Whiston, who translated Josephus. If you own a copy of Josephus, it's probably the translation that William Whiston put out. It's not the best translation of Josephus, but it's the most famous one. It's the one that most people buy when they buy a translation of Josephus. Anyway, he was an Arian too, but he didn't hide it. He told everybody he was an Arian, and he got fired and run out. They wouldn't put up with that. So that's why Isaac Newton had hidden all those years that he was an Aryan, and only came to light. I mean, there were suspicions of it early, but we only found most of his writings on these types of things later on. Anyway, it's the same Isaac Newton that you learned about in school. Ptolemy's canon. Yes. Arianism, I'm just talking about the conflict that Arius brought about and defended back in the early centuries of the Christian era, culminating in the 4th century at the Council of Nicaea, the Nicene Council that was called by Constantine, where they were trying to decide about the nature of deity. When you discuss the nature of deity, it can be a very ambiguous thing sometimes. But there's no question but what Jesus Christ is deity if the New Testament is right. Arius and his followers were saying that Jesus Christ is not God the Son. He's the Son of God, but he's not God the Son. He's not deity. And they have explanations, of course, although I think faulty explanations, for the statement that Thomas made, for example, after the resurrection, when Thomas looked at Jesus Christ and said, "My Lord and my God," and Jesus did not correct him. If there was ever a time to declare the truth of Arianism, it was on that occasion. Jesus could have said, "Oh, you must not call me God." But he didn't correct that because Thomas was right. Jesus is God. He is the second person of the Godhead. And the New Testament is clear on this. The book of John in particular makes this very clear. So there shouldn't be any question about this in any of our minds. But there was a big question about it when the Roman Catholic Church was in its incipiency and just getting going. Constantine had a council to decide on this, among other issues. And they decided in favor of the so-called Trinity, which is not a biblical word, but it is a biblical thought. It communicates, I think, the triunity of the Godhead, that there are three who are actually God, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Spirit. They each have their function. They each have their role. The Father is the one who worketh all things according to the counsel of his own will, Ephesians 1:11. The Son is the one who is subservient to the Father. I do nothing of myself, though I do what my Father says. And yet he is God in the was God in the flesh while he was here. And the Holy Spirit is also God. He's called the Eternal Spirit in the book of Hebrews, the 9th chapter. Anybody who's eternal is God. You and I are not eternal. We have not always existed, but anybody who is eternal has always existed and is therefore God. When Peter was talking to Ananias in the 5th chapter of the book of Acts, he said, "Why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit? You have not lied unto men, but unto God." He's calling the Holy Spirit God there, it seems to me. So we have these three who are God. There should be no question in our minds about this, although they have an order in which they work. And they don't cross those lines. God the Father is also the God of Jesus, and the book of Revelation makes this very clear. Jesus made it clear in the Gospels. "I am ascending to your God and my God." He calls his Father my God. There's no contradiction there, that Jesus is God and that he calls the Father my God, because the Father is above him. Everything's subjected to Jesus except the one who subjected everything to Jesus, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15. This was the controversy, and I hope that's enough, probably too much, on the Arian controversy, but it was a big deal, and it's still a big deal in the world today. Our friends who are Jehovah's Witnesses believe basically the same thing about Jesus Christ that the Arians back in the 4th century believed, and that is that he is not God. He is a created being. You can call him the Son of God, but he's not God the Son. And this is one of our big sticking points with our Jehovah's Witness friends. This is one thing that always gets discussed with them when they come to the door. Eventually they're going to get around to asking you, "What do you mean by your use of the word Trinity?" And we should each be prepared to discuss that with them. So it's not like we're talking about just an issue from the 4th century of our era. It's an issue in our time now. And I have met people in some of our congregations who do not believe in the deity of Jesus Christ. We should be able to discuss this and come to an agreement just based on what the New Testament says, what the whole Bible says, really. Because it's clear back in Genesis 1. We have the plurality of the Godhead there. We have conversation going on before the creation of man. "Let us make man in our image." Who is he talking to? You know, so I think this is a clear point. But there have been lots of clear points that have been disputed through the years. And this was one of the big ones. It was on the nature of deity. And so Isaac Newton, smart as he was an Arian. And so was William Whiston, and that's what got him into trouble. But I only went into Newton's background a bit to try to connect with things that we know, because we learned about Isaac Newton in school. He published those three great laws, you know, a body at rest tends to stay at rest, a body in motion tends to stay in motion, and tends to go in the direction that it's already going. These things that are so beautiful, because the truth of them is so simple, and yet he's the one that thought of it. I mean, gravity. Why didn't we think of gravity? But nobody thought of gravity and expressing it in the way that he did. They had all kind of other theories about it, but he figured this out and figured out about the orbit of the heavenly spheres. He could predict when things would occur just based on the calculations. It's way beyond what most of us are able to do. My point about bringing him up is that the astronomical connection. Much of the challenge that was brought against Ptolemy's canon was based on statements by Sir Isaac Newton. Newton put out his revised chronology, Newton is just one of the many chronologies that are available to look at, and Newton got some things wrong for sure, but he did a lot of good groundbreaking work, and he wrote his revised chronology to demonstrate that mankind is not older than he is represented to be in Scripture. That's the reason that he wrote it. Newton did this by pointing out that the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Latins and the Assyrians all exaggerated the antiquity of their origins in order to give themselves and their own nation credibility and status. And he gives a number of solid historical examples of this. Actually, there was a revised edition of Newton's chronology that just came out, put out by a man in Canada by the name of Larry Pierce, just came out recently, that is really interestingly done. The main thing to understand here is this. Where the canon of Ptolemy has no astronomical observations connected with the king and the number of his years in the list, then Ptolemy had to rely on the same materials as any other chronologist. Where Ptolemy does not have astronomy to work with, then he's got the same feet of clay that all the other astronomers have. And that's what Newton is pointing out. It's the use of the astronomic observations that has made Ptolemy's canon so highly regarded. But he only has astronomic observations for some of his listings and not for all of them. Now, it's great to have these astronomic observations to help us with chronology. If we didn't have that, we'd really be up the creek on chronology. One of the very purposes, and this is validated by the first chapter of Genesis because the Lord said so, one of the very purposes of the sun, moon, and stars being there for us in the first place is so that we can tell time. Let them be. Let there be lights in the firmament. And let them be for signs and seasons and for days and for years. So we're supposed to use them for those purposes. Most of us don't know how to do that, but I'm glad that there are some people who are able to look at the sky and the heavenly spheres there and to figure out, with the minds that God gave them, to figure out things that we otherwise would not be able to know with regard to dating things in the past. Now, when Newton looked at the work that Ptolemy had done so long ago, Ptolemy was born around 70 AD, around the time of the final destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans. Newton looked back at this, and Newton, of course, was much, much later on. Newton, by his calculation, said that Ptolemy's list could be no more than a few years off for dates after 604 BC. For dates before that, they could be off any number of years, but after 604 BC, they could only be off no more than a few years. Let me try to bring this down and make a point about what can be done about the impasse between Thucydides and Ptolemy. Thucydides says that the flight of Themistocles was at a certain time. That's different from the time that Ptolemy gives for the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus. Here's the deal. Here's what all of this boils down to, as I understand it. After Xerxes' humiliations at the hands of the Greeks, now, you know, when we look at the backbone of Bible history in chapter 2 and chapter 7, we see that there are these four world empires. They come in big and strong, and then they weaken as all empires weaken, and then they're taken over by somebody else who became stronger. We see under the administration of Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire was very strong. Afterward, there were lesser and inferior kings, and the empire weakened and was taken over by the Persians, the Medes and the Persians. So then the Medes and the Persians begin to weaken. And this weakening takes place in a substantial part during the reign of Xerxes. Xerxes is losing battles. He's losing ground. He's humiliated at the hands of the Greeks. The Greeks are coming on, and they're going to end up to be the next empire, the Macedonian Empire, under Alexander the Great. While I should not say that the Greeks actually defeated the Persians at Thermopylae, I've said that before and been called on it, because actually it was a Persian victory, but it was an extremely Pyrrhic victory, right, Thomas? An extremely Pyrrhic victory. Thank you. We're together on that. The Persians won at Thermopylae, but it was a Pyrrhic victory, and a Pyrrhic victory means you lost an awful lot gaining your victory. At the Battle of Salamis, we all agree that the Greeks won and the Persians lost. Xerxes is getting older. He's going through one experience after another like this, and it crushed his spirit, I think, is what happened, reading between the lines. His spirit was crushed. And so Xerxes then, because he could, you know, you've heard of leaders that said, I did it because I could. Because Xerxes could, he just gave himself over to a life of indolent ease, to the drinking of alcoholic beverages and the enjoyment of his harem, and lived in a constant state like that. After a while in this debauched state of living, Xerxes, getting older, found that his desire and maybe even his ability to govern had become diminished and impaired to the extent that he placed Artaxerxes Longimanus, his son, on the throne as a co-regent with him, to rule with him, to sit beside him. And he did this some years before his death in the 21st year of his rule. Some years before that, leaving the affairs of state largely in the hands of his son. This is my theory, and it's backed up historically as I'm trying to tell you. And if this is true, if this theory is correct, if we can accept what little historical information we have about this, then when Themistocles' flight ended and he arrived with Artaxerxes having just come to the throne, as Thucydides and Charon of Lampsacus reported, Themistocles comes there, but Xerxes isn't dead yet. Xerxes is still king, as some of the historians say, but Artaxerxes is also king. See, this way we can have the best of both worlds if we just postulate this possibility. And it seems to fit with all the historical facts that Xerxes is still alive, as at least his four historians said, but Artaxerxes is king. Xerxes does not have to die in order for Artaxerxes to be king. We don't have to assume that with Artaxerxes in power, his father was dead. As a matter of fact, Thucydides never says, as the prince of the Greek historians, that Xerxes was dead at this time. He only says that Artaxerxes was involved in the administration. Now, here's an interesting thing, if you have happened to have been in a congregation where I taught the book of Esther, I'm sure that I pointed this out, because it's always been very interesting to me that, not, as far as I know, not one historical event is known about Xerxes after the end of the book of Esther, which is very interesting because he lives on years after that, about 9 years after that or so. But there's not one historical event that we know of about Xerxes after the end of the book of Esther. And remember that Xerxes is the same as Artaxerxes, same as Ahasuerus of the book of Esther. He is the husband of Vashti and then the husband of Esther. In the Bible, he's called Ahasuerus, but in history, he's known as Xerxes. We don't know of anything about him historically after that. That has caused some people to think that maybe he did die earlier than we have had reported. But when we talk about a co-regency, this allows the possibility that the other historians were correct in part in saying that Xerxes was alive at the time of the fleeing Athenian Themistocles when he arrived at the Persian court, and that Artaxerxes was the monarch with whom the interview of Themistocles was conducted. Xerxes was alive, but it was Artaxerxes with whom Themistocles spoke. That's what I think. And this way, we can still give Xerxes a complete reign of 21 or 22 years, and we can still maintain the integrity of Ptolemy's canon. Ptolemy's canon is right under this view, but it just doesn't give all the information that we need. Adding this co-regency or pro-regency aspect to the relationship between Xerxes and Artaxerxes doesn't do any violation to Ptolemy at all, because he makes no mention of these kinds of things. So I think that historians generally are moving in this direction. I think in future years, if we live long enough, we'll see the date 464 for the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus. We're going to see that question more. Right now, if you look at just a standard history book, I was just communicating by email, within the last year or two with somebody else who is looking into a lot of these things, and he was recommending a standard textbook that he used in his college classes talking about the history of the Greeks, and that just flatly says, that book flatly says that the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus is 464 BC. Just unquestioned in the minds of those people who write those books and have not given a fair shake, I think, to this possibility of a co-regency. They're not taking into account all the historical information that we do have, or at the very least, they're discrediting some of it unfairly, I think. But I do believe that historians are moving in this direction. You can look at Edwin Yamauchi, for instance, and what he wrote in 1990 on this subject. They're moving in this direction because they understand the problem. Let me tell you the problem. In my copy of Thucydides, and if you have a copy of Thucydides at home, you can look this up. In my copy of Thucydides, which is the landmark Thucydides, which has some commentary on it as well, there is a statement made in a footnote on page 77 of that book that says this, quote, "The date of the accession of Artaxerxes is 465/464. They're going with the tradition here. And then it says, in this footnote, "On any chronology of Themistocles, there is an awkward hiatus between the siege of Naxos and Themistocles' arrival in Asia, and his meeting with Artaxerxes." What's the awkward hiatus? The awkward hiatus is that he's fleeing with all his might from Athens, and he's running with all his might to get to the Persian court over here, but he doesn't get there till years later somehow to talk to Artaxerxes when Artaxerxes finally comes to the throne after his father dies. Well, if we just postulate a co-regency here, we don't have that problem at all. There's no awkward hiatus at all. So the people who put out that landmark Thucydides, they understand that there is a problem here. They say there is this awkward hiatus between the siege of Naxos, which marks Themistocles' arrival in Asia, and his meeting with Artaxerxes. That's in the landmark Thucydides, page 77. That shows a grasp of what the problem is. And what I am proposing to you today, I believe completely and thoroughly, 100%, solves that problem. If we take the year 473 as the year in which Xerxes installed Artaxerxes as his co-regent, then the Jews would quite naturally begin the dates associated with Artaxerxes from that year, because that would be the year, that would be the point from which they would have begun to have their dealings with Artaxerxes as their sovereign. They were completely under him. They were a part of the Persian Empire. They had been moved by the Babylonians, but after the Persians took over, they were part of the Persian Empire, and they were still, most of them, over there in the Babylonian area. So he was their sovereign. From the time that he begins his co-regency with his father, that would be looked on by the Jews. And we're looking at how the Jews looked at things. That would be looked on by the Jews as the first year of Artaxerxes Longimanus. Here's an interesting thing. In 1863, the Journal of Sacred Literature and Biblical Record reported an Egyptian hieroglyphic inscription which stated that Artaxerxes Longimanus was associated with his father on the throne in the 12th year of Xerxes' reign. Now, that was clear back in 1863. People were talking about this, the issue was being discussed, but it was in a rather obscure journal, and it didn't get the press that it might have gotten. But it's talking about an Egyptian hieroglyphic inscription that they had found. Now, to put that in the context of history, you know about Champollion, right? You know about Napoleon and them finding the Rosetta Stone and all that so that they could understand Egyptian hieroglyphics? So this is just shortly after we figured out how to understand Egyptian hieroglyphics. We've only known about this for a relatively short period of time. And that's what this journal is focusing on here. Just a few years after Champollion figured out the key to understanding Egyptian hieroglyphics, which was in the relatively early part of the 19th century, he figured out how to read all these. then we were finding these things that made these statements, this statement like this, that Artaxerxes Longimanus was associated with his father on the throne in the 12th year of Xerxes' reign. So the Rosetta Stone was found by one of Napoleon's expeditions right around the turn of the century, in 1799, I believe. But they couldn't read it. They had to figure out what was going on with the languages that were there. They could not read it as well as they wanted to. It took a few years later that Champollion, there's a book that came out just within the past few years, which is sort of a biography of Champollion. It may play fast and loose with some of the dates. I mean, it's written more in a novel form, but it purports to be a biography at least. But it's, sometimes they invent conversations and so forth that they don't really know what happened. But anyway, that helps to show what Champollion did in helping us to understand the reading of Egyptian hieroglyphics. And the Rosetta Stone does definitely play into that, yes. Other questions or thoughts? Okay, well, taking this year 473 as the year of the accession of Artaxerxes, then you can work out the Daniel timetable on your own. You don't need me. Well, I think I told you in the last hour that there are three other little tiny chronological considerations that would help if you keep them in mind. I'll just try to list them now. Remember that when we talk about the 20th year of Artaxerxes, the 20th year starts after the 19th year is over. And to say that it's in the 20th year of his reign is not the same as saying after 20 full years. A lot of times people will make that mistake. But for the same reason that the 1900s were the 20th century, then the 20th year begins immediately after the 19th year ends. So right after that 19th year ends, that's when we would start the 20th year of the reign of Artaxerxes Longimanus. And when we also take into account the fact that people don't start reigning just on the first day of the year, whatever day that is. You know, it was only when we changed to the Gregorian calendar that we went to January the 1st being New Year's Day in America, in the British Empire. Prior to that, it was in March. So there's once again, we're back to those calendric issues, which are so confusing. But the point here is that the 20th year starts at the very end of the 19th year, and that if his reign had a part of a year prior to New Year's, it could even lap back a little further than that. That would be perfectly possible because the ancient people reckoned inclusively in almost every culture. I can't think offhand of an exception to that. The Greeks, the Romans, the Jews, the Persians, these people, they reckoned inclusively, meaning that a part of a day was reckoned as a whole day, and for many of these people, a part of a year was reckoned as a year. If you started reigning in that year, even if it was just the last piece of the year, it would be reckoned as the first year of your reign, and then your second year would start with the beginning of the new year. So taking those two things into account, the fact that the 20th year really begins after 19 years, and that there probably was a little bit before that, then that would affect our way of calculating, if you're really trying to get specific about it. Now, I have to warn you, when we try to get real specific about these dates as Americans who like to figure things out, we have to realize that the ancients, and I think I started the class by saying this, the ancients didn't always look at time that way, since they didn't need to. They just didn't have any way to measure it that specifically in the first place. And so their world was a slower world. It was a world lit only by fire, and they didn't care as much about the specifics of it. This is why I think, and we can prove this, I believe, that in the New Testament, the Bible, Old Testament or New, the expression after 3 days means the same as on the third day. The expression 3 days and three nights means the same as on the third day. And I think we can show this. Well, that messes us up if we want to be more precise than the Bible is about some of these things. We have to take inclusive reckoning into account. But having said that, let me mention to you that there are a couple other things we need to remember about the chronology as we work out the years of the Daniel timetable. The second thing I wanted to mention to you is that there is no zero year in going from BC to AD. There's no zero year. So if you just do a simple subtraction calculation, you take 455 or wherever you're going to start because of the calculations we've done with regard to the 20th year of Artaxerxes Longimanus, if you were to take 455 as a place to begin and you just do simple subtraction with that 490 years, you're going to get off by a year if you fail to take into account that there is no zero year. In our line of integers, we have that zero, which takes a place. We go from negative 1 to 0 to positive 1. But in the chronological timeline, we go directly from 1 BC to 1 AD as the next year. So that's what I mean when I say there's no zero year. And that has to be taken into account. And also we have to remember that Jesus Christ was not born in the year 1. Jesus Christ was, we don't even really know what year he was born in, which is an amazing fact. But after all this time, we've still got different ideas about what years he might have been born in. We've done astronomical calculations about the star that the wise men saw and what that might have been. But as nearly as we can date it, Jesus Christ might have been born in the year 4 BC. The reason we know that much is that we know that Herod the Great was alive in 4 BC because he tried to kill Jesus. When the wise men came and said, "Where is he that is born King of the Jews?" He immediately, after questioning them, he tried to figure out when they saw the star, and that way he knew who to kill. That is, how old to kill the baby, how old of babies to kill down at Bethlehem, so that he'd be sure he got the right one when he was killing the slaughter of the infants there. So we know that Jesus Christ was alive. We know that Herod the Great was alive when Jesus Christ was born. Herod the Great died in 4 BC. There's no question about that. Therefore, Jesus Christ was born no later than 4 BC. And we've got a calendar that's just off. And to try to correct it now wouldn't be worth it, so we just keep this calendar that's off, and we're just supposed to know that it's off by at least 4 years. He could have been born 5 or 6 BC. That's possible. We don't know precisely when he was born. It's not given to us precisely. Apparently, we don't need to know it. Later on, when he began to be about 30 years of age. See all the qualifiers in there? It's not on his 30th birthday. It's not even when he's 30 years old. It's when he began to be about 30 years of age. It's vague, and that vagueness is built in there for a reason. I'm not going to question why God did that, even if it messes up the possibilities that I would have of putting it as precisely as I might like. I can't always pick the mulberries the way I want to pick them. I've got to try to roll with the flow here. And when it says he began to be about 30 years of age, I think that's precisely what it means. When he was around 30 years old, he may not have been exactly 30 at that time. And evidently, I don't need to know any more about it than that. So with all of these provisos and these little stones to look at along the way, you can roll out the Daniel timetable there as well as anybody else. If you start around 455 BC, then you come to the end of the Old Testament. After that, those first 7 weeks, that 49-year period where the street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublous times, as we read in Daniel 9, up to around 406 BC or so, the time when Nehemiah was working there, was getting all of this job done. And, yes. Oh, Mike.
Do you think that when you enroll the years that you'll take in the Gentiles coming to the church?
Yeah, I think that's possible. Now, I can't prove that, and that is an excellent question. When you come to the last week, and the last week is the one that's discussed the most in our time because the people who take the premillennial position, which is almost everybody in the evangelical movement and a lot of other places these days, it happens to be a very popular point of view at our particular time in history. There have been other times in history where virtually nobody espoused it, but now when you listen to radio and TV, if you do, which I don't very much, but you may, when you listen to the religious broadcasting on radio and TV, it's almost always from a premillennial point of view. And so the last week gets discussed a lot, and they often want to take the last week and put it off in a place by itself. It is discussed separately in Daniel 9, the first 7 weeks, and then the 62 weeks that come after that, which makes a total of 69 weeks. And then in this last week, as we saw in the last couple of verses there, the very last verse, He shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. This is Daniel 9:27. He shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. Now, the time when Jesus Christ caused the sacrifice and the oblation to cease was at the time of his crucifixion. This was when that great sacrifice was offered once for all people, once for all time. All the Old Testament sacrifices were funneled down together. All the sacrifices that the Jews were doing at that very time when the temple veil was rent in twain from top to bottom, all these were funneled together into the crucifixion of Jesus, and he fulfilled all of that. He made it so that nobody ever needed to offer an animal sacrifice again. So that was the time when he caused the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. It was in the middle of that last week. And then the question that Tom has asked leads us to the question, well, what about the rest of that week? We've got 70 weeks proposed here. We've got 490 complete years proposed. So what's that last week about? And I think that very well may be what we're talking about here, the ushering in of the Gentiles, when the Heavenly Father broke down the middle wall of partition that was between us and took it out of the way. And what Jesus did on the cross, of course, triggered that action, but it didn't come about. The first several thousand Christians were Jews. There was no Gentile Christian until Cornelius. And so in Acts 10, we come to the beginning of our real unity in Christ with Jews and Gentile believers together. So to me, as I would see this unfolding, taking into account the things that I've mentioned to you, we come down to about the year 29 A.D. Remember that our calendar is off. But we'd come down to what we call the year 29 A.D. or so. And this would be the beginning of the ministry of Jesus, the time of the baptism of Jesus, when he goes out turning water into wine and so forth. And then the crucifixion would be around 32. And then it's possible, when the week ends around 36 or so, that this would be the time of the ushering in of the Gentiles. Now, some historians think it took longer than that to bring the Gentiles in. I like the symmetry of having the Gentiles come in at the end of the week. I don't know that that could be disproven, but I can't prove it either. But it's an excellent question. I wish I knew more about that, but I don't know how to find the information. I've tried to look at everything I could about it, but I can't prove that the Gentiles come in at the end of that week. I'd like to believe it, though. We got a question back here, Gaylene. I don't know. Roy, I think you, well, we got a mic coming from both directions, so who get there first is uncertain.
Back to our earlier beginning when you were talking about the source, the charts that you would like us to have. Could you give us the source for those?
Yes. I actually have them here. The three that I was thinking of, and they're all from the same series of charts. I think it's a series of, I think, seven different charts, and I have passed these out. Some of you already have these from me in other Bible studies for other purposes, and I have passed them out a number of times, various ones of these, but there are three, some of the charts in the series, and I think there are seven of those. Many of you may have these at home, probably a lot of you do, but I believe there were seven in the series. They used the chronology of Thiel, Edwin Thiel, who also wrote some books about chronology, specializing in the history of the kings, the mysterious numbers of the Hebrew kings, and he wrote another one about the chronology of the Hebrew kings, which contained much of the same material. But his chronology is used here. And again, please, if you look at these charts, remember everything I said about chronologies. You can look at standard chronologies here, or Thiel's chronology, and there may be a lot of things to commend it, but there are people who oppose it as well, and there are some scriptural things to consider in that they say in opposition to Thiel's chronology. So all of those should be taken into account as you make up your own mind. But the first one I would have passed out to you if I was passing out charts would be the one called Old Testament Kings and Prophets, and I know that many of you have that. This probably is one of the most famous ones and one of the most useful ones. The reason I got into this was years ago I tried to teach kids classes about the divided kingdom, and I'd make a chart, you know, okay, Rehoboam so many years, Jeroboam so many years, and it's not long before you're out of sync. Well, what's going on here? Well, there's several things going on. When it says somebody reigned 17 years, that doesn't mean it was precisely 17 years. If you say I'm 40 years older than my younger son, That's not precisely true. It's approximately true. It's true in round numbers, and we accept it that way. But if we were going to be precise, then we need to get down to months and days and so forth. And that's going on with those numbers. The man didn't reign precisely 17 years or 22 years, just to start out that chronology. But there were differences there. Plus, there were a lot of co-regencies, apparently, involved in that, too. And those are all outlined according to Thiel's theories on this chart of the Old Testament kings and prophets. And then the second thing I would have passed out to you, and this we would have just barely needed for this ninth chapter that we've looked at, would be the chart called the period between the testaments. This helps for that intertestamentary time that's so confusing and that we need all the help we can get on. That period where we get into some of the prophecies from the book of Daniel and elsewhere. We're trying to understand those. This is a great chart for that, I think, to just help us understand. Like in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, there's about 20 different people there that are being prophesied. And you can find them on this chart. This chart really helps with Daniel 11. In fact, I think that's why it's named, why it was made in the first place. It has many citations from Daniel 11 on it. Now, when he gets into the part where he's going to take off on that last week about the millennium and all that, it's not so good, but a lot of it is very good. So that would be the second one. And the third one I would have given you if we were really going to try to be precise about some of these dates, as precise as we can, is the one called the Chronology of the Crucifixion and the Last Week. And I've passed this out to some of you as well. I remember one time at Excelsior Springs, I gave one of these to everybody in the auditorium, whoever they happened to be at the time. So I know some of you have got this. But it's just, he gives five different views of that final week of the life of Christ as he's coming up to the crucifixion. And he tells the pros and the cons as they are seen, and the strong points and the weak points of those. Was he crucified on Thursday? Was he crucified on Wednesday? Was he crucified on Friday? And how does that all fit in with all the facts as we know them? But one of the reasons I would have passed this out to you would have been because of the astronomical considerations that are found at the bottom of the chart. And also, I like on the backs of these charts the writing that's there. That helps to explain what's on the chart side of the charts. And I have tried and tried through the years to make copies of these that I could just pass out to people, and they've been very unsatisfactory, even with the good copiers that we have. You may know of a way to copy them, but I've never really found out a satisfactory thing. I remember over in Indianapolis, I tried to copy them, and you could sort of use them, but not very well. Is that you, Fred? Go ahead. Oh, you know, that's a good question. I don't know if they are or not. I buy them from a guy over in Indiana and get a special break on the charts if I buy enough of them at a time. Yeah, copyright 1962 by John C. Whitcomb. I guess they are. Now, I never even thought of that when I was copying them and passing them out. Well, now, I'm sure they probably are online. In fact, yeah, somebody was showing me something. There are lots of these things online, so I'm sure you could go online and get things and copy them off that would be this same material. Gaylene's got something else there.
Are they published by John Hurt?
What?
Are they published by John Hurt? Who's the publisher?
This says copyright 1962, 1968, 1977 by John C. Whitcomb. That's the same John Whitcomb that has written some creationist literature. Here, this one on the crucifixion and last week is copyright 1976 by James L. Boyer. And the one on the between the testaments is by John C. Whitcomb. But the man that I know of that I get him from is over in the top part of Indiana. A very friendly man to deal with. And, you know, if you're just dealing with a congregation, the price is not prohibitive, and they're nice 8.5 by 11 plasticized sheets. People can put them in a notebook. And once you've got it, you've got it. You don't have to keep taking it every time it's passed out from that time on. I think I get them for about $2 a piece, and that would have been $6 a person to give you those three. And I thought about doing it, but I didn't think about it very long, as I may have said because if I thought that every one of you was just absorbed with this, I might have gone ahead and done it. But I know that most of you just don't care, and you don't have to care. We don't all have to care about the same things when it comes to this. So I thought that it might be a waste. We might find them laying around on the ground and have to throw them in the trash after people stepped on them. So you got to want it bad enough to get it, to procure it. And it is easily findable. If you get, what do you got, Roy? Who is it? Oh, Eric.
Rick.
Yes.
I've got a question in regards to the passage in Daniel. Christ being the one that in the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. What's your explanation further then? And on a wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end of that is decreed and poured out on him. What's the continuation of that then?
The continuation of that, as I see it, is the destruction of Jerusalem. I think Jesus pinpoints this for us in the 13th chapter of the book of Mark. There are three chapters in the Gospels that are dedicated primarily to the destruction of the temple, as I understand it. Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. And in Mark's exposition of that, he includes the words of Jesus that refer to this very thing. In Mark chapter 13, I think it's the 14th verse, when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not, as written by the prophet Daniel, whoso readeth, let him understand. And he's talking about this very thing. So I think the Lord is telling us that this refers to the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, having said that, a thing that's said can refer to more than one thing. Well, it's too bad we didn't get to talk about the 2300 days. So it's over? I guess it's over. Well, let me just conclude with something. Since I'll conclude with the ninth chapter. I think it deserves just another word, if I may. Because at the time that we're coming up to the time that Jesus was going to be born, the pagan peoples were jaded with their own paganism, with their own heathen practices, with their own, they were just satiated with the rites and rituals of the gods and the goddesses that they had. And the pagan writers said that the womb of the world is troubled as if the progeny of the gods would come to earth and cleanse it. You read this in Virgil. You read this type of thing in Horace. Everything was leading up to this time. And when the Magi, the wise men, they went to Herod in Jerusalem and said, "Where is he that is born king of the Jews?" They weren't the only ones that were looking for this progeny of the gods. People didn't know what form this was going to take, but they were looking for that. They followed that star because we have seen it in the east. They didn't follow it all the way over. We have seen his star in the east, and that's why we came over here. In the first six verses of the second chapter of Matthew, that shows there that the rabbis knew the truth. Herod inquires of the rabbis. They know what's going on here. And they searched this out accurately and diligently in verse 7. And then the star shows up again. And God allows the wise men to find him and finances their journey down into Egypt with gold, frankincense, and myrrh. The point is, and we didn't look at the first part of Daniel 9 either, but Daniel was praying that that's what precipitated this Daniel timetable being given to Daniel and to us through Daniel. Daniel, after he prayed, just shortly after that, his people started back, and Daniel apparently took and showed King Cyrus where Isaiah had named him before his birth in the 44th and 45th chapters of the book of Isaiah, so that Cyrus was predisposed then to let the people go, let the pioneers come back. All this fits together, and the point of all this is, and everybody here can appreciate this point, a God who is this sure and faithful to the promises that he gave us chronologically is still our God today. He promised us something. He's not slack concerning his promise, and he's going to bring it to pass. Thank you so much.